Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 20th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Reading from an Afro-Judahite Perspective, presented by Peter Nash, number NAPE 2006-01. Let's listen in.
I got a present this morning from Jeff Kirsten and Gray. About 25 copies of something we didn't have time to use yesterday. It's 10 things everyone should know about race from the PBS series Race, the Cardinal Illusion, which coincidentally we both used in classes yesterday.
No, we
should
just share.
And one of the reasons I'm happy to do this to you because I talk a lot about race when I'm up here, and I need you to understand that this is more in line with what I actually think. I mean, everything I say, I do believe, well, mostly. It's really important for me to have a chance to understand that I don't think race exists among human beings. But there is one human race. And best scientific evidence today illustrates that race is a biological factor. Race as a cultural factor is quite a different thing. Which, because we pretended for several hundred years that it's a scientific fact that human beings are different races, we created some sociological and anthropological problems that we need to unravel, sort of like you're knitting there if you want to take that apart. It's quite a task to unravel it. Before we can actually get rid of the white privilege that we've been talking about in all sectors of society, and that the church is unfortunately no different from the rest of society in that regard. Let me just highlight 6 of the 10 here. Race is really a modern idea, and on Friday I'll talk a little bit about where I think it came into Western Christianity and Western scientific thinking. But that's for tomorrow. But it's not an ancient idea for all time and all places. The terms that get translated as race during the late Enlightenment didn't mean race the way we talk about them today. I was quite stunned when I moved to Brazil in 1995. Went to a football game, and one of the football teams, which is known as the German football team, had a huge flag that said, Raça Pura. I was terrified because I was sitting in their section. And my host explained to me, no, that just means force, commitment to the same values. It doesn't have anything to do with genetic race. Yes, yeah. Brazil, Germans, yeah. Kind of scary for a minute there. When we used to talk about bloodlines, and we still talk about bloodlines and horses and dogs and other mammals, that's all pretty mythological. Came out of some unfortunate religious thinking coming out of the Spanish Inquisition. We have a doctrine in the house, so I'll be very careful when I say this. Race today in scientific thinking has no basis in genetic research. Confirm that for me, or correct me. There is no gene, or there's no set of genes, there's nothing in that we can identify in the genome, at least so far, that says this one is black, this one is Latino, this one is white. There are characteristic markers for hair color, skin color, eye color, and so on, but they're not indicators for one's race, because there's more variation, but I think that's actually one of the next points down here. That there's much variation within what we have traditionally called races than there is across races. So that if you take even a pile of tile, even if you take a population sample of Swedes, there'll be more diverse genetic diversity within among those Swedes than there will be from Swedes to Nigerians. And more diversity within the group of Nigerians than if you go from the Nigerians to the Lithuanians. Human subspecies simply don't exist. We are one species. Proof of that, my kids running around here, a couple other kids I've seen here, that the way we talk about species in biology is, can you interbreed? Are you a breeding population? That is a species. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but if you can breed across the line, then there are no real lines as far as biology is concerned. Number 8, and on more of what we've talked about this beginning of this week, race has been normalized and has been used as a justification for social inequalities. Well, black people are this way, Latinos are this way, Italians are this way, Jews are this way, Asians are this way. And then go talk to the Asians and then I'll see the Chinese are this way and the Japanese are this way. And, you know, they'll break it down for you in their categories and their hierarchies among the Asians themselves, as well the Latinos, as well the Afro-descendants in this country, who will do it differently from the way it's done in Brazil or in Nicaragua. Most people don't think there are any black people. One of the things that I started here, number nine, race isn't biological, but racism still exists. That race, as an anthropological, sociological set of categories and constructs, exist, and that's what we need to dismantle as we move through our lives. And then the color blindness is not, will not end racism. A dear friend said to me once, "Well, I don't see you as a black man." I said, "Well, what am I, a gray eunuch?" and I'm sure that in most cases, if a man says to a woman, "I don't see you as a woman," that's cause for insult. "I don't see you as a man," cause for insult. We need to recognize that cultures bring with them certain characteristics, certain desires, certain ways of looking at the world, and we need to move away from the norming and the insistence that one act in accordance with my set of values. Varun and I have known each other for 30 years. That's why he's sick of me and he's not here today. But one of the things that has kept us friends since college is that we were two of six black men, or six black people at a college of 350 students. And so that forced us into some boxes together that we weren't necessarily comfortable with. But also, we were able to acknowledge our differences with each other. And he from Kansas City, I from Saginaw, Michigan, saw the world in very different ways. And we made space for ourselves, for each for the other, to expand those boxes or get out of some of those boxes that our Missouri Synod classmates at Concordia had made for us. So colorblindness is not an option for getting rid of this. Colorblindness, in reading the Bible, which many people will claim that they have, but I think I illustrated yesterday, is not the case. It's not an answer either for getting at the truth as we look at this stuff. So, today I'm going to be reading from a book called Reading Race, Reading the Bible, and it's okay, I'm not cheating because I wrote it. It's my stuff, or stuff that I stole from other people through the legitimate processes of stealing stuff from other people in the academy.
Yes.
I hope we'll get heated and interesting and interested, and a lot of stuff will be going on. So, those of you who don't live here in the wilderness, here's my email if you're interested in maintaining communication with me at some point. So, that as well as the introduction. Oh, and if you haven't started the tape now you can start the tape. what a joke. Yesterday we talked about white privilege in terms of image and imagination and how the world is formed and normed in most cases in the West as white and European through a specific set of epistemological assumptions. This is how we know things. This is what we can know. This is what we can't know. And so some things we don't even get to ask about, and other things we're forced to ask about even if we don't care about them in university, in seminary. It was interesting to listen to Paul Olson yesterday as he kept looking for a definition of good poetry, which seems to me, we all learned something about good poetry when we either gleefully went to English class or suffered through English class in high school and college. And Paul was struggling to first to define it and then undefine it because he was working with African American poetry, and some of it was very popular poetry, and it was an interesting dance that he was doing with the poetry and with himself and with the assembled group. So as we try to decenter these norms and reconfigure this epistemology, these ways of knowing what is true and what is possibly true, we have to find new models for thinking about Scripture. And I showed you a lot of pictures that many of you have seen growing up about what the people in the Bible look like. And it's really funny when they get so classically medieval or so classically Renaissance dressed, so typically European in their style, their facial features, their skin color. And then suddenly, as the book on the Nativity showed, one of the, I think it's Balthazar, who was traditionally known as the wise man, who was a dark man, at least, if not an African from the East. And so then suddenly there's one, and you go, wow, I never thought of that. There must have been something wrong. Well, I had the map on the board yesterday, or something like a map on the board yesterday, illustrating that everything that happens in the Hebrew Bible happens with brown people. And yet, when we represent them in our popular images, it's Charlton Heston, Richard Gere, Jeffrey Hunter. When we get to the New Testament, by then we do have some Europeans interacting in the coming over from Rome. But just barely Europe. You know, remember that the Italians weren't exactly white in the United States when they first got here. Ted Neely from my generation has Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ Superstar. Carl Anderson was Judas, the bad guy, was an African American playing on the play. Great movie. One of my favorite films, but it's got some problems. I was hoping Sam Bell would be here today because I'm going to take his name in vain, but he didn't come to defend himself, so that's tough. After the session, he said, we talked a little bit about myth, and that this is all mythological stuff. And I said, well, but it's all mythology. And he said, well, not exactly mine. And we didn't pursue that. I was hoping we'd pursue that a little more this morning. I want to move us from myth, although I use that term, and I want to talk about myth a little bit this morning, to metaphor. I'll talk about metaphors first, because metaphors literally saved my life. If it hadn't been for George Lakoff writing about metaphors in the 1970s and 80s, I probably would still be a graduate student, and my life would be weirder than it is now. Lakoff and Johnson in Metaphors We Live By, and then in a different way, 20 years later, in Philosophy in the Flesh, lay out for us, these are linguists who have become something more than linguists. Lakoff has gone all the way to philosopher. I'm not sure where Johnson is headed and followed his career. That it is impossible for us to have human communication that is not metaphorical. We can't get concrete without having metaphor that the word chair has nothing to do with chair, so to speak. It's something that is a metaphor that we would agree upon. Door is meaningless until we agree that it has something to do with getting through an otherwise impenetrable spot in our existence. So we begin to expand those images, all of which have to do with the body, according to Lakoff and Johnson in Philosophy in the Flesh. And build upon those metaphors ever more complex ways and ever more abstract ways. So, my colleague Fred Strickard in New Testament is the somebody's life chair of humanities at Wartburg College. Well, he's not a chair. He holds the chair. Well, no, we don't actually have a slick chair. But he occupies it somehow. You know? And in in the old days, there used to be actually in the old Eden schools and Eden rooms for the universities, used to actually a chair endowed by a certain family or industry, and a professor would actually occupy that chair, and that's where his or her stipend, or almost always his stipend, came from. Someone holding a chair, occupying the chair, everybody in academia understands what that means, but there's no chair. Mm-hmm. And often we find when we get the chair that there's no money to go with the chair anymore. It's been eaten up over the generations. Everything is, all the language that we use, all the descriptions of things are metaphors that take us from one place to another based on what our body can take in or occupy or feel, one of the five senses. If you can't taste it, Matt Lightcoff would argue, if you can't taste it, if you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't feel it, you can't hear it, you can't take it in through one of your five senses, you can't describe it. I mean, you have to use some sort of sensory, bodily metaphor at the base of your metaphor at any rate before you can talk about it. So one of the questions that I like to ask is, when you talk about the body of Christ, what body do you imagine? That we were yesterday. When you talk about the physical being of Moses, what body do you imagine? Even though this is, you know, we get the Moses sort of semi-mythological, as Sam Bell was saying yesterday. I'm not sure how much of what we got about Moses was actually about Moses, or some Moses-like collection of characters. When you think about these people, what bodies do you usually imagine? Feminist theory has done a lot with this in terms of the body, because the norm for most Western thinkers when we talk about body is the male body. That's why one of the reasons we're so much better at dealing with prostate cancer than we are with breast cancer. Because men are doing most of the research, and they're more concerned about that male normative body than the female body. Mm-hmm. Fair to say.
About prostate cancer. Yeah. I think it's fair to say. I think that might not be the best example. Probably heart disease is the best example.
Okay. Different kinds of heart disease than the one you get.
Right. Women have a totally different aspect of how they manifest heart disease that is only just starting to be recognized when it's all studying men.
Okay. I'll change my example. until recently, the body that we imagine in medical studies.
Oh yeah, in medical school, the standard is the 70 kilogram man. So they say, if we have a 70 kilogram man,
for medication,
for anything,
for dosage, for
everything, it's a 70 kilogram man.
we're back to having normed this, and we've normed it as somewhat of a Western. Let's say 70 kilogram man. Maybe if we admit that this mythic man was somewhat Middle Easterner, maybe he's only 60 kilograms, a little shorter, Mediterranean looking. I want to challenge you today to think about different ways to look at these stories that allow you or might allow you to see Moses, David, Judah, or his Judah's descendants, which David would be one of them, Saul, as something other than white guys with hands weighing about 70 kilograms. So the four ways that I do this in the last chapter of this little book is talk about genealogy, talk about geography, talk about anthropology, and the fourth I put in parentheses because I don't really consider myself a theologian except for under duress. I've taught in theological schools for almost all of my career, but I'm really a language guy who reads and teaches languages that they need to do good theology, which means they usually ignore me. and we'll talk about that. Well, maybe as transition, we'll talk about the fourth one first, because it has to do with norming. James Cone, in 1968-69, I think I've got the dates right there, but I'm not positive. Published two books. He published his doctoral dissertation from Garrett Northwestern Joint PhD program, which was Black Theology and Black Power, and then he published Gotta Be Oppressed. So he is pretty much the father of Black Theology as a formal discipline in the United States. He's still teaching at Union Theological Seminary in New York for a few more years. He was in conversation with Latin American liberation theologians who were already publishing in Spanish and Portuguese. Leonardo Boff, Justo Gonzalez, Juan Sobrino, and a host of others. He was in contact with some African liberation theologians. Remember, the 50s and the 60s, nation after nation gained its independence from the colonial powers, Portugal, England, took until the 90s, until the 80s, to finish off the African portion of the imperial British Empire. Who else had holdings down there? The Portuguese? Belgium and Germany, Namibia, Rwanda, which we've seen how much that was messed up if you've seen the film Hotel Rwanda, and how taking these ideas of race from Europe messed people over. But the important thing about Cone is that Cone redefined blackness so that he could stay in conversation, or define blackness so that he could, redefine blackness so he could stay in conversation with the Latin Americans and with the Africans, and to some extent a little bit later with the Asian liberation theologians. He was very clear that he was writing immediately after his three doctoral readers, for his community. He's an AME pastor from Arkansas. And it's very important to hear that I believe that all theology is contextual. If you don't have a context to which you're speaking, if you're trying to speak to the universal Christian, then you're speaking to no one, because there is really no, except for me, no universal Christian. No one who gets it all, no one who experiences it all. So each theologian speaks to a community or maybe a couple of communities that have decided to talk to one another. So Cone was very clear that he was talking to African-Americans and any Anglo-Americans or Caucasian-Americans who might want to listen in on that conversation. And he said that blackness in the United States was primarily the experience of oppression. This was shortly after, he grew up in Arkansas in the midst of Brown versus the Board of Education. He grew up in segregated schools. He knew what that was all about, and that was his experience. And he was talking about his experience in defining blackness for people who had experiences like his, who were shut out of jobs, who were shut out of schools, who were shut out of all the avenues of opportunity that we value so much in the United States. So oppression equals blackness. So if you are legitimately oppressed in Cone's scheme and legitimately identify with the oppressed, it's solidarity, not I feel sorry for them, not simply empathize, but enter in solidarity, Cone will allow you to call yourself black. And he then allowed all of the Latin Americans who were also in the 60s separating themselves from, and then again through the 80s and 90s, separating themselves from colonial power, to identify themselves as black, and clearly the Africans were black, but it was the colonial experience rather than the slave experience that defined their oppression for Jim Cone. So anybody who's oppressed in the Hebrew Bible or in the Bible for Cone sees as black, and he sees the Exodus. He uses the Exodus motif as the primary metaphor of Israelite oppression coming out of Africa and finding their way into freedom as a model for African Americans and other oppressed people. Every black theologian, well, I can't say every, I don't know every black theologian in the country now. I used to, because there are so few of us. A black theologian with lettered black theologian. There are only these teaching in the States as of 2000. There are only about 200 of us. So I We all had to go through the cone experience, and that was defining for me. In the 90s, I finally got around to saying, look, he's not even a biblicist. He may know Greek, he may know Hebrew, he may know Latin, but he hasn't been trained in at the graduate level in reading ancient texts the way we have. He's missed some steps here. And let's go back and reconsider some of this. For example, he seems to me to have taken the European approach to Egypt, that Egypt is not black. They were. They're like all, again, this PBS series talks about if you walk from Central Africa up to Sweden, you will not find a point at which black people stop and white people start. You will see a gradual change because these are the places where peoples have first mutated, basically, away from being African into being more adapted. That's what I'm looking for. Adapted in their skin color and their hair textures and so on to be more suitable for the northern climates. And so you have the gradual sweep. And then Egypt is one of those places where in Upper Egypt, which is actually southern Egypt, you're still very African, very Sudanese, and they're actually called Aswadis, which means the black people. And you get up into the northern, which is lower Egypt, lower Nile, and they're more Mediterranean looking. So Egypt is one of those places that has an interesting mix, has an interesting history of north-south competition. If you look at the representations of the Egyptian pharaohs, after about 2600 BCE, the traditional headdress is actually two crowns, the crown of Upper and Lower Egypt. There have been the Nubian influence and the Ethiopian influence and representing the influence from up around Memphis, just south of the delta. Two groups that fought back and forth, and you've got 30 dynasties, some from the south, some from the north. They're all talked about as Egyptian. If you look at the iconography, you see all kinds of people that you might find in an AME church today, from very fair skin to very dark skin, very broad features. So, way more than I expect to talk about Conan is that Israel. If you will allow for Cohen's definition, anybody who's oppressed and truly identifies with the experience of being oppressed and truly works to end oppression for Jim Cohen, at least in 1968, 69, could be black. So, and that's a theologian's way of getting at things or a philosopher's way of getting at things, not a history linguist's pseudo-sociologist, pseudo-anthropologist, would be that. Genealogies. First, I'd like to look at this, is that the Bible itself is, at moments, at least during the moments of the priestly writer, and a few other places, obsessed with genealogy. And it's the places of the Bible we all skipped. So-and-so begets so-and-so, so-and-so begets so-and-so, so-and-so begets so-and-so, and goes on and on and on. I want to suggest that any place that you get a genealogy, they're trying to tell you that we have roots in something, with someone important. And these are seldom accidents, or places where people mention forebears. These are not accidents. Let's think about, can you think of some of the genealogies that include Africans, or Hamites, or Cushites?
From the Bible?
Yeah.
It sounds familiar, but I don't remember which one.
Right.
I have to look at my book to remember this. And did anybody remember? You guys didn't believe me when I told you I didn't have a Bible, did you? If we look at Genesis 10 and 11, we have in 10 we have a table of nations, and then we have genealogies. Moving us into Abraham and Sarah. In the Table of Nations, they divide the world up obviously among the three sons of Noah. It's immediately following the end of the flood narrative. And it has that nasty little curse of Ham, or actually, we call it the curse of Ham, but if you remember correctly, it's the curse of Canaan. It is the Canaanites who are cursed, who are thought of as descendants of Ham. And the Hamites are the North Africans and the Canaanites, and the Phoenicians, which is an interesting connection. So, spheres of Egyptian and Libyan, primarily, and maybe Ethiopic, certainly Ethiopic because of the Kushite, influence along the coast of the Levant. Maybe even that might be helpful, or something like that might be helpful. Pretend this is the Mediterranean, this is Cyprus, and this is Crete, this is the Nile Delta, and Egypt here, Libya over here. Let's see here, and so all of this area is the Hamitic world. Actually, down here in Ethiopia, Kush as well. The Semites are these people over here in Mesopotamia, and some of the people over here, the Hebrews will be identified as Semites, go all the way down into the Arabian Peninsula, so the Arabic languages. And the Japhethites are over here, and they play almost no part in the story. They know that there are people, sort of Europeans or pre-European, because Europe itself is a social construct. But they play almost no part in the Old Testament story. They show up briefly in the 12th century BCE, and then again probably around the 5th, 6th century, they show up. And then we've got some problems with this. You know, this is you know, where Sam Bell was right. This is mythology. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, nobody would accept this as science, as a scientific genealogy. This is the way they understood themselves, or understood or explained the world around them. These myths of origin. So we've got the Persians over here, the Medes and the Persians over here, who don't get included in that, but not the way we would do it today. We've got the Hittites up here in Anatolia, who get included in that, but not in the way we would include them today. So there are, you know, people who come in earlier, whom today we would identify as Indo-Europeans because of the languages that they speak or spoke, who don't really fit the way that we don't really fit this mythic model. But let's just touch on a couple of them. See if I can get genealogy, where somebody begets somebody. Tell me about Moses' family. Who are Moses' bride or brides? What do you remember about Moses and his love life?
Back to the Sinai.
So he flees from Egypt after he becomes a murderer and hooks up with the family with Zipporah, who is a daughter of a Midianite priest, apparently, because this is the guy who teaches Moses a whole bunch of stuff about who Yahweh is and how to worship properly. This will become the name of the God of Israel, of the Hebrews. Any other stories about Moses that you can remember in his bride?
Mm-hmm. Isn't there something with a prostitute or a former prostitute?
No. No, not with Moses.
Somebody else.
Wander.
But we'll get to that story.
Wasn't one of them a Cushite?
A Cushite. In Numbers 12, there's this great story that does all kinds of things in the theological frame that elevates Moses and pushes Miriam and Aaron down to secondary status. Moses is walking around, apparently strutting around, because he's the one who talks to God. And Miriam, his sister, who took him out of, you know, got him out of the basket that his mother had put him in, told Pharaoh's daughter about this baby, told Pharaoh's daughter about, watched Pharaoh's daughter draw this baby out of the water, told Pharaoh's daughter about the woman who had just happened to have milk and be happy to be wet nurse to this baby she just pulled out, which is, of course, his mother. Probably wiped his butt as a baby. And she's really kind of upset with her brother, also older than Moses, because Moses is walking around like he's the only one who talks to God. She says, they say between them, is he the only one that the Lord speaks to? Does the Lord not also speak to us? And they get kind of mad because they think that this is, you know, the modern twist to the interpretation of the story, one of the Afro-American twist, because he's got an Ethiopian wife. He thinks he's bad. Usually, up through about the 1980s, this was interpreted as, oh, he's got a black wife. Of course he's a jerk. Look what he's done to our family. No, I think if you read what the biblical text says about Ethiopians, this is a trophy wife. This is hot stuff. Now, the question is...
The Cushite was the trophy wife?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, well, we learned back Fort Wayne and those schools was at Naples. Oh, he's got a black wife. Something's wrong. You know, that's embarrassing. No. These are the according to most ancient traditions, the tall, beautiful people, like you and me. The great, powerful warriors. In the Odyssey, there's a phrase in Book 15 about... Zeus absence himself from Olympus for a month every year and takes the rest of the gods with him to Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. The original people, the first to honor the gods. Why? Because it is they who know how to throw a party. Mm-hmm. This is in the Odyssey, cited in Diodorus of Rome, a first century Roman historian, who goes back and forth as to how credible he is. And that's the way, unfortunately, we all use ancient sources. If we like what they say, they're good at this point. If we don't like what they say, they're not so reliable there. So this is you know, the ancient impression of the Ethiopians is that they are bad. You're going to go to war, you want them on your side. These are the people, the second people in history to domesticate horses. First up in Anatolia, about 1700 BCE, 1600 BCE, we already have in Nubia, down near the Sudan, we have domesticated horses that will then serve as the chariot pullers for the Egyptians. Mm. When the Egyptians needed chariot horses, they went to the Nubians, they didn't go up the Anatolia.
Mm. So are Nubia and Kush two terms for the Ethiopian region?
Yeah, Nubia. This is one of the problems. Nubia, Kush, Meroe in the Roman period, they all get used, unfortunately, rather interchangeably, and they represent broadly the same region. Africa beyond the south and southeast of Egypt. The Nubians in the beginning of the 3rd millennium BCE. The Cushites are the Egyptian, that is the Israelite term, the Hebrew term. Ethiopian is the Greek term. Meroe is a term during the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. But it's not always exactly the same area. Uh-huh. And another point here, it's that up until about 15 years ago, the Nubians were treated as subalterns of the Egyptian Empire. Now there's massive material showing that the Nubians were rivals, partners, and sometimes, and often, the actual pharaohs of Egypt. And probably, you know, there's one well-respected document that dissertation that suggests that the Nubian pyramids are the prototypes for the Great Pyramids of Egypt. Mm-hmm. The reason that we didn't know a lot of this stuff is a lot of this stuff was salvaged in the 1960s when they were building the High Dam at Aswan. Mm-hmm. And so they had tons of salvage excavations, and that became, that's what the beginning of the end of Nubia as the appendage of Egypt, and Nubian studies as research in their own right. Mm-hmm. So, back to Moses and his Ethiopian wine. Well, for the first problem here, and I don't have a solution for this, so I opt for my predilection. I don't think there is an academically viable solution to this question. People are going to go one way or the other based on their predilections. Did Moses have two wives or one? And for once in the Hebrew Bible, so this makes it really inconsistent, I'm going to say he had one, and that Zipporah was in fact Ethiopian. I didn't draw the Red Sea in here this time. Horn of Africa. This is modern-day Ethiopia. And yesterday when we read about Candace and the Ethiopian eunuch, there is a tradition, which is not very well documented academically, but there are trade connections between these folks all through 3rd, 2nd, 1st BC millennium. These cultures are in contact and interchange. Some people put the reign of Candace here in what would be modern Ethiopia, and others put the reign of Candace in the Arabian Peninsula. There's a kind of unspoken, we wish we could prove it better agreement that these cultures are in close contact. This is the area that Moses is supposed to have fled to in the peninsula. So, a lot of us, not all of us, by not even probably not maybe 40% of us, want to make this the area where everybody says this is where Moses found his first wife at the well, or his wife at the well, and whether or not she was an Ethiopian, a Cushite, whether these two cultures were considered together or not is the question. And about 40% of us in the field say yeah. This is what happened in this one line.
Yep. Wouldn't in some ways the fact that the Ethiopian church is so Hebraic and so very connected to the Moses story and the Moses tradition, might not that sort of support some of that?
Yeah, except it's not convenient to the majority opinion. And that's kind of what I've been saying for two days now. We tend to follow the evidence that we most like. When you see somebody following evidence that he or she doesn't like, then you probably have something closer to the truth in ancient Near Eastern studies. Problems with traditional interpretations like that, although I use them all the time, is that you've got that tradition, the one you brought up yesterday, the Ethiopian eunuch as traditionally the initiator of the Ethiopian church. He went his way happy. He returned home happy and presumably telling people what he had experienced at that river on the way out of Jerusalem. Another part of the tradition, which gives us the Rastafari, is that when the Queen of Sheba, who was connected also traditionally with very little would normally be accepted as academic evidence so far, is connected with Candace, and she in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church supposedly, traditionally, this is where I want to return from her visit to test Solomon, pregnant by Solomon, and that's where the tradition starts. That's where another tradition starts, that Menodaki, their son, is what brought Yahwism to Ethiopia, that it goes back to the 10th century BCE, and that's why it's not surprising to some of us to see Ethiopian Jews in the 20th century who need to be rescued. There's a living tradition. So that's a tradition that gave us Haile Selassie, is the Lion of Judah, which in the beginning of the 20th century was a huge Pan-African movement, and literally gave us the Rastafari. tradition versus hard scientific fact that we always work with in biblical studies. So, if you will allow for the jumps that I've made, you know what I'm saying? What I'm trying to say is that in this one genealogical stream, Moses has an Ethiopian wife. Question is, did their children, was she Zipporah or was she somebody else? Was she someone else? Was she a second one? I contend that she, for not very much reason other than I like this idea better, I'm upfront about that. And there's no evidence, there's no hard evidence to the contrary, that he had one wife and that his children, so a third of the Levite tribe or half of the Levite tribe that we talk about in the Bible, is Afro-descendant. So some of the Levites, by genealogy, are Afro-descendants. And there are some others. But I'll come back to that one for the last, just in case anybody hasn't done. A second way to talk about the Judahite or Israelite self-identity as Afro-descendant or as connected with the Africans is, what happens in the Jacob-Israel story with the 12 sons and Joseph and so on?
Well, they all end up in Egypt.
They all end up in Egypt for a couple weeks?
400 years.
All right. Let's see, do we have any Swedish Americans here? Norwegian Americans? Danish? German? Irish? German-Irish? Right. The rest of you, Fessa, help me out of this real quick, because we're in
Russian.
Russian?
Yeah. Eastern European.
Eastern European?
That's
true. Did you raise your hand already?
Yeah, British.
British. British and German, all right? Which is basically the same thing. how long has your family been here?
Pardon?
How long has your family been here?
Oh. 1800.
So?
About 100
years. 120, 130 years?
Mine's about 100.
About 100?
150.
150. Anybody's kind of been here for 400 years? Raise your hand. Part of our family's been here more than 400 years. We think.
Yeah.
All right. But you're all Americans. So after just 120 years, we consider ourselves Americans.
50.
After just 50 years, we consider ourselves Americans. Our families have been here. What happens when you spend 400 years in a culture? You're part of it. You may have roots. I mean, it's important for us to say, especially in the Lutheran Church. No, I mean, most of our churches are pretty ethnic. You know, whether they're Orthodox or Protestant or Roman Catholic, you know, you go to a Polish Catholic church in Chicago, or you go to an Irish Catholic church in Chicago, you go to a German Lutheran church in Chicago, you go to a Swedish Lutheran church, and when you cross those lines, you get disoriented for a while. You know? So it's important. Those roots are important. And they never let go of those Hebraic roots, whatever those are. Some people say they're sociological rather than, most people now say they're sociological rather than ethnic. But they've got this story, this primal story of we spent 400 years in Egypt. And that's a huge part of Israelite identity.
Well, of course, you see how big that is because, you know, where did Mary and Joseph go?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't go to the beaches in Greece. I mean, they don't go to Denmark.
I think actually they did go to Copenhagen. They just set Egypt to throw them
off. Yeah, I mean, that's where they looked to go to when they needed to hide out.
And what do the prophets keep saying to the Israelites? Don't ever go back. What do they say to the kings? Don't sell your people back into slavery there. You came out of there. I don't know. We don't have a law here at Holden or a rule here at Holden against walking on the ceilings. Because nobody's doing it. You tend to have rules against things that people do or want to do. So you've got this one huge 400-year tradition of we spent 400 years there, we spent our time there, we're formed there. During this period, probably, and let me just say that I had a great privilege in my coursework to sit at the feet, when I had the feet literally, but to sit in a seminar with Samuel Noah Kramer and Torkel Jacobson, who were the giants of the middle of the 20th century in ancient Near Eastern studies. One was a Sumerologist, both were Sumerologists. And one of them, and I can never remember which one of them said this, they got into this argument about history. What is history? Is it the cyclical Egyptian, every king does the same thing that the other great kings did before, or where there's a variation and somebody does something different? Is that when we first get history? And it's an interesting argument that we don't have time to, or I don't have that much interest in. But one of them said, in modern history, you have to prove that something is probable, based on the evidence. In ancient history, you have to prove that it is not improbable based on the evidence available, because you have much less evidence and much less consistent annals and monumental architecture and so on to deal with. So you have 400 years, this is just one example, 400 years of experience in Egypt. Yes.
But weren't they in a separate part of Egypt, in Goshen, and how much real segregation did they just stay within their own culture and their own...
You've been to Minnesota?
Minnesota, yes.
You have been, and they're in a separate... Yeah. You know, the Swedish Americans are in a separate part. You've been to Northfield, to St. Olaf. Yeah. But, you know, the Norwegian American intellect, the musical formation, is that what these people are still very much... North American. So I'm going to argue that even if you do segregate people within the culture, they're still going to have huge vestiges of the culture. You know, Verlaine and I, you know, we separated African Americans for, you know, 180 years of our existence as a nation, and still we have many, many characteristics of, you know, what did I learn in school? The privilege part for me in my elementary school would be to get to play the part of George Washington. Yeah. I absorb that. You know, talk about that usually as a negative characteristic of people in a segregated society, but it's also an identifying marker for most of us. So yeah, the tradition is that they were separated because the Egyptians were extremely, for the most part, xenophobic, we say, but There's a lot of evidence that they weren't so xenophobic. For example, Joseph.
I was going to say, the tradition of the story was that he was the second ranking official in Egypt. I mean, from that point of view, then his people are as defined. I mean, certainly would have been part of the society. You know, again, I mean, whether they actually were, whether this is simply a mythological sort of story, but again, it's a foundational idea and identity.
Mm-hmm. They look back to that. And whom did he marry? After he escapes from nasty old horny Mrs. Potiphar, gets thrown in prison for trying to rape her when she tried to seduce/rape him, he gets elevated to the position of second in command and marries an Egyptian religious princess, the daughter of one of the high priests of one of the religions in Egypt. So all the children of the half-tribes of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh would be Afro-descendants. And so we got one example here, one example here. And there are others. If you take the time to do it, give me a little leeway, we get up to five of the six tribes that have Afro-descendant and Hamitic, Cushitic influence in their genealogies. So, genealogy is clear. Geography is clear. There are other stories, people going back to Egypt. We talked about one of those examples yesterday with the Elephantine community. Jeremiah, about 10 years into the exile, flees or is kidnapped to Egypt. There's always this traffic back and forth to Egypt, and people are always being born and always consider themselves Israelites slash Judahites slash later after the exile Jews. Anthropology. I used to call this mythological, but then I switched it to anthropology, cultural anthropology, of course. Parallel practices, parallel construction. When we look at especially the period of David and Solomon and the period of Josiah's reforms just before the exile, so about 1000 when the empire, the Davidic Empire is being structured, and when the temple is being built, and then about 625 when Josiah is taking the throne and instituting his reforms. These are the two most Israelite periods. Israelite in the case of David and Solomon, Judahite in the person of Josiah. And these are the periods where the practices, the structures, the construction models are most Egyptian. Solomon's temple is built on an Egyptian model imported through Phoenicia. So we'll just leave that at that real quick, because I'm almost out of time. Also, myths of origin and other etiological narratives. Where did we come from? You know, go back to this one up here with geography as an etiological story. Myth of origin. We have 400 years in Egypt. There are several others that are take longer to explain. I want to go back to genealogy for just a minute because this is the shocking one, and people want to shoot me sometimes when I tell this story. One of my favorite stories in the Hebrew Bible is Genesis 38, 1 through... the whole chapter, actually. Anybody remember what happens in Genesis 38? Pardon? Okay, so Genesis 37 is the beginning of the Joseph story.
Joseph or somewhere.
And then it breaks off in 38, and we talk about the story of Judah. Judah apparently has revolted with his brothers and what they've done. They've thrown Joseph, they want to kill Joseph first, and they throw him in a pit, they sell him into slavery, and then we rescue. Theologically, sociologically, we rescue the patriarch of the tribe of Judah by having him separate from his nasty brothers who have tried to kill Joseph. And then this nice little story about the line of Judah, and then we go back to the Joseph story for chapters 39 through 50 of Genesis, to the end of Genesis. But what does Judah do? He separates his brother from his brothers. He goes down to a Canaanite region. Remember, I've said that Canaan is included with the Phoenicians and the other Hamitic peoples. So they're somehow brown people, and that's why we know we get to oppress them if they're Israelites, because the Canaanites are the ones who get cursed when Ham does whatever he does with Noah. You know, I need a map for this, but I know you're smart enough to hang on with me. And what happens in this story? First 11 chapters, verses of this are really amazingly quick and nasty and brutal. He goes down, he marries a Canaanite woman, and they have three sons. Er, Onan, and Selah. Er takes a wife from the region. Her name is Tamar. So he takes a wife from the region. He's in a Canaanite region. I'm assuming, I don't have proof, it doesn't say she's a Canaanite. So, you know, you could shoot this out of the water if you want to right there. But that's, you know, I have as much evidence that she is that as you have that she wasn't. So, depends on which way you want to argue from silence. Again, Er, that's something we don't know what it is. If Ben's got it, he drops dead. Right? What's the Levirate law? The law of the brother-in-law. You know, Levir is Latin for brother-in-law. And that is that the brother-in-law or another near male has to go to this widow and provide her with the raw material to have a son, which is her right, who will replace the dead man in the genealogy, in the line of authority in the family. Onan, second son, figures out mid-coitus, apparently. Oh, wait, I'm the oldest now. I get half of everything. I get the biggest chunk of the inheritance. Let me withdraw at this moment to consider the possibilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get it. You know, Onanism has nothing to do with adolescent boys and girls. It has to do with, I mean, that's what we call it, but Onan's sin is not so much spilling his seed for enjoyment as spilling his seed on the ground for greed. Mm-hmm. And oppressing this woman even further to deny her right to bear a child who will replace him, who will be over him in the inheritance succession. Mm-hmm. So he's struck dead. Judah, champion that he is, good man that he is, says, go back to your family, and I'll call you when little Selah here is old enough. Now, he's seeing this woman as a man killer. Mm-hmm. He's worried about his son. Years later, Selah's an adult, and ready, or he's old enough to marry, perform the service. And so he's still hiding him out, so to speak. He goes down for a sheep shearing festival. And Tamar has heard that her father-in-law and his best buddy are coming down for the sheep shearing festival. She dresses herself as a cultic prostitute.
That's right.
Seduces her father-in-law. He has no cash. He wasn't planning on, so he gives her two marks of authority. His staff, interesting pun in English anyway, and his seal, whether it was a cylinder seal that hung from his neck or a signet ring, he hands over to her and says, I'll send money soon to pay for this religious encounter. And she accepts it. And, of course, because it's a justice issue, she's impregnated right away. Months later, Judah hears. First, Judah sends his buddy down to collect his stuff and pay the debt. Eric says, there's no cultic prostitute around here. What are you talking about, man? We're not like that. And he says, well, rather than be a fool and be made fools of and looking all over for this woman, I'll just take her stuff back. And if she shows up, she shows up. That is what I understand from the story. Months later, he hears that she's played the prostitute, she's pregnant, and he arranges to have her stoned and burned. What we all would do, right? With our daughters and mom. And he goes, ready to have her eliminated and Selah and be free to marry and reproduce with him ever. And she says, you're right, I have done this, and when you find the man who owns these, the tools of his staff and the seal, you will know who the father is. And he changes his mind. Mm-hmm. And he says, she is more just, more righteous than I am. And she has twins. And this is the preservation of the line of Judah. Through Judah and his Canaanite, I believe, daughter-in-law. Another Hamitic tradition, genealogical narrative tradition, myth of origin, they kind of join together here, and a little bit of the geography to give us the line of Judah. Now, why do I say this for the end? Because people get really upset when I tell them that David is probably an Afro-descendant. It's not so much the David, it's they think a little while, and they think, ooh, who was from David's line? That's it. So, that's it for today. I'm already over time.